College students are gearing up for spring break at the end of this month, and when they return, it'll mean one last push before finals in May. We're having a conversation about grade inflation on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Some universities are now taking a closer look at the efforts at the effects of grade inflation. Some university deans are required to defend why the average grade points of their college students are rising higher than in previous years. Is an A really an A? Let's talk about it. Stuart Roystacher is a writer, scholar, and former geophysics professor at Duke University. He is a Milwaukee native. Hello there. And did his undergrad at UW-Madison. He's done extensive research on grade inflation, the results of which can be found on this website, gradeinflation.com. Stuart, welcome to the program and welcome home to Wisconsin.
Thank you. I'm glad to be talking to you today.
Well, let's start by looking at your research. You write that 5 years ago, the average college student had about a 3.15 GPA, and 45% of all A through F letter grades were A's. Can you put that into some historical perspective for us? Can you compare that to what was happening a half century ago?
Yeah, about a half century ago, A was the third most common grade. About 15% of all grades were letter A's. And today, A is the most popular grade, somewhere around probably, as of today, if trends continued, I haven't looked at this year's data, probably somewhere around 46% nationwide of all grades at four-year colleges are A's or A minuses.
So we were at about 15% in the number three slot 50 years ago. Now we're at around 45, hovering 45, 46% letter A grades. What has evolved over time? What's happened here?
Well, there have been two eras where grades have gone up considerably. One was during the Vietnam era. From the mid-60s to the early 70s, the percentage of A's doubled, went from about 15% A's to about 30% A's. And that was a rapid increase. It seemed to be the result of two main factors. One was the Vietnam War. If students stayed in college, they could avoid the draft. And professors collectively decided to make sure that students stayed in college by giving them higher grades and not flunking them out. You didn't want to flunk out a student back then because it meant they might end up with a rice paddy in Vietnam with a gun and might end up dead. That's serious. That's a serious repercussion. So grades went up during that time. Then from about 73 until the early 80s, grades actually went down a bit from the rapid rise, and that was followed in the mid-80s by a gradual, very, very gradual rise in the percentage of A grades that has continued until this day. It's a real slow, inexorable rise from about 30% A's to about 45, 46% A's today. And it's the equivalent of taking one to two students every year in a classroom of 100 and giving them a half point or third of a point rise in grades. So you take one student who used to be a B-plus student, you give them A minus. Or you take one student or two students who used to be C-plus students, you give them a B minus. It's very, very slow. It's very, very hard to detect until you start looking at decade-by-decade changes, which is what I've done. And when you start looking at a decade-by-decade rate, you start to see it. And especially over the last 30 years, when you start looking at it for a 30-year period, you can really see it. It's real, and it's been going on since the early to mid-1980s.
Well, this rise, then, doesn't have a really tidy reason behind it, like the Vietnam War. So what is it due to?
Well, students aren't getting any better nationwide. They're about the same, at least in terms of test scores, and as they were in the early 80s. Their study hours are down. They used to study about 20 hours a week at a typical four-year college. Now they're down to about 12 hours. So you can't say that they're working harder. You can't say that they're better students. You can't say that technology has improved learning considerably. And what seemed to have, what has happened over the last 30 years is that the culture of the college campus has changed, where students are now viewed as consumers of a product. That's a change that took place in the 1980s. Students were no longer acolytes in search of knowledge, but they were consumers and purchasing a product, and you have to keep consumers happy. You have to ensure that they graduate. There was emphasis on graduation rates that is still present today. That began in the 1980s. And the customer's always right. You give them a high grade, and you do that gradually, year by year by year. And in some schools, there is actually recorded discussion at faculty senate meetings about how they have to raise their grades in order to keep up with other schools because they want to make sure that their students get good jobs or go on to good graduate schools. So there's almost an arms race of keeping grades high in order to make sure that your students do well. They graduate, and when they do graduate, they do get the better opportunities, whether it be in professional school, graduate school, or the better jobs that might be available worldwide.
Stuart Roystercheir is with us talking about this arms race that he sees in grade inflation. He's a writer, scholar, former professor of geophysics at Duke University, does an extensive research on grade inflation at gradeinflation.com. You can join the conversation, 800-642-1234. If you're a college student, what has your experience been with grades? Did you earn an A when you know deep down that you probably shouldn't have received it? If you're a teacher, how do you make your grades? How do you decide? Call in, tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Stuart, let's look a little bit about what's happening inside public universities versus private universities. Is there a significant difference when it comes to grades and grading?
Yeah, at private universities, grades tend to rise at a more rapid rate than at public schools. And the best guess that I can make as to why that's happening is that the tuition is higher. And when you pay that much money for a college education, when you're spending $60,000 a year for tuition, $55,000 a year for tuition, you expect something in return. You expect a higher grade. So there is a persistent, more lenient grading that exists at private schools relative to public schools. And it does seem to give students who graduate from private schools a tiny bit, but a perceptible, real bit of an advantage when it comes to trying to go to not just graduate. Their graduation rates are much higher on average, but also to get into the better graduate schools, get into the better professional schools, and get those better jobs.
But at private universities, could there be an argument that these are smaller classes, these are professors who know these students perhaps quite well, who know their capabilities, who have a much better handle on these students, and maybe not so much inclined to shift some of that grading to perhaps a teaching assistant or someone else to just who doesn't have a connection with a student? Could there be relationships here?
Well, there are personal relationships that occur in small classes, irrespective of whether the school is private or public, that make an individual reluctant to give someone a harsh grade.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just human nature. But even in large classes, introductory classes, and in private schools, whether it be in calculus or chemistry, the grades are higher. So even in impersonal settings where there are teaching assistants at research universities that are private, like Harvard, Yale, Duke, where I taught, the grades are higher than they are at corresponding public schools. So there just seems to be a slight, about a 0.1 difference in GPA between private schools and public schools that has been persistent now for about 50 years. Until the 1960s, schools across the country, and I'm talking about four-year colleges, graded about the same way. Harvard gave about the same number of C's, B's, and A's as anyone else. But since the 1960s, actually from the 1960s to the 1980s, this differential between private and public schools started to emerge. And by the 1980s, it had fully emerged, where it just was a fact that private schools graded more leniently than public schools. And you can see the divergence start in the 1960s, and by the 1980s, the gap has been fully developed. And in terms of grade inflation, the private and public schools are both going up, but it's like two parallel lines separated about a point by about a 0.1 GPA gap.
Let's go to Lynn now, joining us from Racine with a question. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, good morning. I think that your guest does not take into consideration parental expectations. When our daughters were looking to go to school, we really looked at if they were going to go to private schools, that we had an expectation that they would be in and out in 4 years and that they would maintain a high GPA. I might have felt a little less pressure to do that if they were at a state or public school where I wasn't paying so much tuition. But I think that there is something to be said for parental influence here, and I don't think it all just depends on how much tuition you pay.
Lynn, thanks so much for the call. Stuart, your reaction?
Parents have an influence on how well students do, right? Whether they be at public school or private school. If a student feels hovering in the background as a parent that wants them to do well, whether it be in public school, private school, at a college level, or at high school or grade school, they'll tend to do better. So there is that influence there, but it is partly tuition-driven. And as that caller noted, if she wasn't paying so much tuition, she perhaps wouldn't be, pressuring is the wrong word, but wouldn't be so concerned about her children's grades and wouldn't be so concerned that they graduate in 4 years. So there, it's difficult to separate those two factors of high tuition and parental involvement. Certainly parents are more, not all parents, upper middle class parents are more involved in child education in terms of trying to talk to deans, talk to actual professors, than they have been in the past. And, you know, I would get calls when I was teaching from my chair that the dean had heard from a parent about the grade that a student had received. And that was something that just didn't happen 30 or 40 years ago.
A couple months ago, Purdue University President Mitch Daniels wrote an open letter to his university discussing the importance of academic rigor and his concern that the average GPA at Purdue has been rising. Daniels didn't attribute the rise to students working harder, being smarter, or striving more. Instead, he blamed this national trend on grade inflation. Stuart Roystechair is a writer, scholar, and former professor of geophysics at Duke. He's done extensive research on grade inflation, has his results on his site, gradeinflation.com. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. College students, what has your experience been with grade inflation? Did you earn an A when you know deep down that you probably shouldn't have received it? Call in, tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit here on the Ideas Network. We're learning that college GPAs have been on the rise steadily over a half century now or so. That is not immune to a single discipline. Both the humanities and the sciences have seen rising grades since the 1960s. But the starting points for the rise were different. That's according to Stuart Roystacher. He's the author of the website GradeInflation.com, a former geophysics professor at Duke University. You can weigh in at 800-642-1234. Why do you think we've seen a rise in A's being handed out over the last couple of decades? And what do you see as the implications or the consequences here? Call in or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Tara now, joining us from Madison. Hi, Tara.
Hi, it's Tara, actually.
Tara, sorry.
No, that's okay.
I had a 50-50 chance there.
I know, sorry. I should have had her spell it differently.
Go ahead.
Anyway, I had two things. First, I went to school in the college in the 90s, a public university in California. So my parents paid out-of-state tuition. So, you know, the stakes were really high. But in my experience, I felt as if I had to work really hard for my grades. That's just my personal thing. The first day of organic chemistry, a higher level class, my professor told us 60-75% of you will end up failing after the first test and drop out of my class. He just flat out told us that. And it was indeed true. The class went from over 100 students down to 30, 40, maybe tops. I had to stick with the class because I needed it in order to get to the next class, you know what I mean? The progression of things.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was really kind of telling, you know, just that you will fail, basically. So in my experience, I felt as if I had to work pretty hard for my grades. And then the second thing, I wanted the speaker or the guest to address maybe the potential consequences of grade inflation in terms of the hardworking students, or maybe not so hardworking students, that end up graduating. So they might be getting into better grad schools and jobs, but are we making lazy people, or, you know, like...
Just the implications to society.
Yes.
Yeah, societal
yes.
implications. Stuart, go ahead.
Well, one reason... let me back up and say that students are working less in school in terms of average hours studying than they did 30 years ago. And one reason is that we've made college easier for them. But another reason is that because tuition is so high, more of them are working real jobs. The idea that you go to school for 4 years and during the school year you concentrate on your studies is still there, but it's not as common. And when a student is putting in 20 to 40 hours a week outside of the classroom to pay for their college tuition, to pay for their room and board, something has to give. And one reason I believe, and this is just a conjecture, that we've made college easier, we've made grades higher, is to accommodate the working student, which is a good thing, except that in the end, because grades are higher, because their students are spending less time studying after hours, they're learning less. So I hesitate to call them lazy students, because they're working. They're working a real job in addition to going to school commonly. But they, at the end of those 4 years, they have learned less. So we have a less educated society on average as a result of making college easier over the last 30 years. And the implications of that for society are something people can speculate on. But the fact is that students are learning less.
Well, let me give you some pushback here, because some critics would tell you our IQs are increasing and that school is more rigorous these days. We're setting up young kids on a path to college-level education, you know, kindergartners learning division, for instance. And they would add that students who are going to college are selected during the admissions process because they're pretty much sure bets that they will succeed. So what do you make of those arguments?
Yeah, nationwide, there's no indication that students are better prepared when they get to college-level classes. Percentage of students taking remedial classes when they get to college has increased, so at least at four-year schools. So you could say, you could make some arguments that because we've increased the percentage of students who go to college, on average, the quality of student is actually slightly worse. So it just doesn't jibe with national averages. However, I should say that at a local scale, there are schools where the average quality of students has improved. It's probably true that at UW-Madison, where I went to school, I think I was a pretty good student, but, you know, on average, the student is
But that's debatable, right?
Right. Okay, that's debatable. You could talk to my professors. All of them are retired, but, you know,
We could make some phone calls here, Stuart. Carry on.
You could. I still meet socially with my undergraduate advisor, by the way. So he comes to my parties, so we have a very good relationship. You could talk to him about what my undergraduate career was like. At any rate, on average, at some schools, the quality of student is better. But in terms of, and you would expect them to do better in terms of grades, but that's a secondary effect, and you can do a pretty good job of quantifying that. And basically about 20 to 30% of the grade rise at those schools where students are measurably better over the last 30 years is attributable to better students. The other 80 to 66% is due to something else, and that something else is we've made classes easier.
Let's go to McKinsey now in Madison. McKinsey, go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I just have a question. So from my perspective, I feel like students now are kind of making this choice between getting good grades and then trying to get experience in their field, so taking an internship perhaps. And so now kind of what I'm hearing maybe is for the students, maybe like myself, who are overly focusing on grades, that those grades are kind of meaning less. And so I'm just wondering, or just slightly concerned now, maybe could you speak to, you know, the importance of internships versus grades, and maybe is one better than the other, or advice for students who are graduating now who maybe have higher grade point averages but have less experience in the fields that they're going into?
Yeah, Stuart, go ahead.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know what employers are looking for, and I would be stepping up over my, what is that expression, that American expression, stepping up over your skis?
Above my pay grade, or I don't know.
Above my pay grade, yeah, that would be above my pay grade, to opine as to whether employers want to see internships versus higher grades. They do tend to discount grades more than they once did because they know they're all high. So they have to come in with other evaluations, make other judgments based upon other pieces of information, whether that be past experience, recommendations, although recommendations are inflated too. That's a funny thing that's happened over the last 30 years where professors do feel obligated to laud students and their abilities more than in the past. So those tend to get discounted too. So how an employer makes a decision as to whether they're going to hire a certain individual is a mysterious thing to me, but grades have less emphasis than they once did in the evaluation process.
Let's go to Jim in Milwaukee, who is a college professor. Jim, go ahead.
Hello?
Hi, Jim, you're on. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so I did my undergrad in the mid-80s, got my PhD early 90s, and in the 6 years from when I was an undergrad to when I started teaching undergrad.
Oh, Jim, are we losing you? Can you still hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, good. Go ahead.
So, yeah, anyway, so after I received my PhD and started teaching, I noticed a big difference in the attitude of the students. And I'm wondering, you commented on this briefly earlier about how they're viewed as consumers of education and not just students. But what I see is a a push by administration to make the students happy. And if you want to get tenure, you have to keep the students happy. And I'm wondering, I don't know how you can tease that out, if there's any influence on grade inflation on that aspect.
Jim, thanks so much. And certainly in this era where social media is in the mix as well, and ratemyprofessor.com. Stuart, go ahead.
Yeah, concomitant with the last phase of rising grades, which began in the 1980s, was the persistent use of student-based evaluations of teaching performance that were not common in the 60s. By the 1980s, they were very common. Now they're expected. And those student evaluations of teaching performance are used in tenure decisions. And not only are they used in tenure decisions, but sometimes they're posted, and students will shop for classes where they see, not just posted. Let me back up. The student-based evaluations are university and college produced, and then there are outside websites that you mentioned, like RateMyProfessor.com. I think that's the name of it, where students can actually see ratings. And those ratings tend to highly correlate with grades. So professors who grade easier tend to get higher grades. If you want to be a popular professor, if you want to have high enrollments, and high enrollments in your classes mean that your department will get a higher budget, if you want to increase the chances of getting tenure, you're going to try to keep your students happy and have high student evaluations. And so that does play a role in the overall rise of grades that's taken place over since the 1980s. So the student-based evaluations of teaching have influenced grading practices. That seems to be clear.
Because there are implications on the tenure process, who gets tenured?
Right, exactly. So if you get low evaluations, it may have an adverse impact come tenure time, if you're a tenure-track professor. There's been speculation that adjunct professors, because their positions are more tenuous than tenured professors, will grade easier, and that doesn't seem to be the case. It seems to be that this rising grade process, or the era of rising grades, which began in the 1980s and continues to this day, seems to be independent of whether a professor is an adjunct or tenure track or tenured. Everybody's grading easier.
We're having a conversation about this study, Rise in Grades, what to do about it, where it came from. Stuart Roystechair is with us. He's done extensive research on grade inflation. His results are on his site, gradeinflation.com. Gathering your questions, your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Are you a teacher? Do you think grade inflation is a problem? Are you pressured to hand out higher grades? Call in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Shannon now, joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Shannon.
Hi. Thank you for having me today.
Sure.
I actually am a teacher at a two-year college in Green Bay, and I teach physics, which isn't easy. I expect my students to work 6 to 10 hours a week outside of class still. But I found that what's changed a lot in the time since I went to college to now is that teachers are being taught how to teach at college and not just lecturing the content in which they're experts, but making sure that they're giving it in a way that students understand and can access better. For example, my classroom is flipped, so my students are getting all of their lectures outside of class as homework. And inside of class, we're working on that application and what it really means. So that by the time that they've spent their 5 to 10 hours inside of class each week, they've had more access to the content through the instructor and through small group instruction and through hands-on learning than they did when I was in college.
And what does that, Shannon, have to do, and how that structure is, that having to, you know, go to the lectures outside of class and then apply it in class, what implications does that have on the grades you hand out?
Well, so there's a lot of research that says that brain-based learning is stronger when students are doing more hands-on application. And the hands-on application with things like physics are a little harder because the tools are not as accessible outside of class, the research, or the laboratory equipment and things like that. So our students are achieving better because we're more focused on them and on their needs as learners and less focused on a more traditional path where professors might be more worried about their research and they just come in and lecture and it's more of a side job that they have while they're working on the research. Now, because, and I agree with you, what you've been saying, that our students are clients and we have an obligation because they're the major source of our funding, we're more focused on making sure they're getting what they need to be successful. We also have tutoring groups set up with highly qualified professionals running the tutoring groups instead of just a teaching assistant. There's a lot more structure in place for the students to get the resources they need to be successful.
So lots of safety nets in place, as Shannon describes here, structure to help them make their grades. Stuart, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, thanks, Shannon, for that comment. I've actually observed these flipped physics classes like she's teaching, not at UW-Green Bay, but at UNC Chapel Hill. And I've been impressed by what they're doing. And so locally, there have been efforts to improve the quality of instruction that should mean that students learn a little more, right? And should be more, and teaching is more effective in those types of environments. They're not pervasive, but they are present. There is one curious thing, or there are lots of curious things, but one particular curious thing that I'd like to mention with regard to grades nationwide is that two-year colleges, like the school where Shannon teaches at, stopped having grade inflation in the early 2000s, whereas four-year colleges continue to have it. Grades have plateaued at those two-year colleges, maybe even gone down a bit because Fs have been rising over the last dozen years or so. And why two-year colleges don't have grade inflation continuing? Certainly grades are high. A is the most common grade at two-year colleges. Is a mystery to me. I don't have an explanation for it. I can make some speculations. One is tuition is low there, and so the sense of entitlement that students may have is relatively low. But that's just speculation on my part.
Shannon, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Diane in Poinette. Hi, Diane.
Hello?
Hi, Diane. Can you hear us?
I sure can.
Go ahead with your question.
My question is actually in follow-up to the person earlier who was talking about the significant number of students that dropped a class because they were expecting to not pass it. And did the research that you did take into account those students also? Did it look at numbers of students who dropped a course, you know, now versus, you know, 40 years ago? And are there possibly more students, you know, who would get lower grades dropping out now because of the pressures of parents, parental expectations? And is that maybe a reason why there's a higher percentage of A's versus before?
Thanks, Diane. Stuart.
Yeah, there was a trend in the 60s through the 70s of students being more wily shoppers, dropping out of classes earlier than they once did, or dropping out of classes with increased frequency, and also taking classes with increased frequency as pass-fail, that had an influence on the overall averages from the 60s through the 70s. And those trends seem to have plateaued since the 80s. Students aren't dropping out with any more particular frequency than they now than they did 30 years ago. And they aren't switching over to pass-fail with any more frequency. And in fact, they're actually taking pass-fail less on average nationally, it seems. So that secondary effect was present from the 60s to the 70s and influencing overall trends in grading, but doesn't seem to be having a pervasive influence now.
Research from the College Board last year found at the high school level that even as grades were rising, scores on the SAT college entrance exam went down, not up. The researchers found that grade inflation is accelerating in the schools attended by higher income Americans, who are also much more likely than their lower income peers to be white. We're having a conversation about grade inflation and what to do about it with Stuart Roystechair. He's done extensive research on grade inflation. His results are on his site, gradeinflation.com. Gathering your thoughts at 800-642-1234. If you're a teacher, do you think grade inflation is a problem? Is it an issue? Are you pressured to hand out higher grades? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. Over the past couple decades, high school GPAs have risen considerably, while SAT scores have fallen. Researchers say the conflicting trends indicate schools are engaging in grade inflation, or the practice of artificially lifting student grades by lowering standards for awarding A's. And this issue of grade inflation carries right over to the college and university level. We're talking about it on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The author of the website gradeinflation.com, Stuart Roystechair, stays with us. He's a writer, scholar, former geophysics professor at Duke University. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think grade inflation is an issue? If so, what can be done to solve it? Stuart, talking a bit there about grade inflation at the high school level, this conversation is not immune to the college level.
Yeah, so high school grades have been going up concomitant with college grades, and that's not coincidence. It's always been the case that colleges grade harder than high schools, and on average there's been about a 0.5 GPA differential between what a, on national averages, between what a graduating high school student can expect in their GPA once they get to college. So they're going to see their grade point drop on average nationwide by about a half a point on a four-point scale. When grades rise in high schools, it means that some students have never seen a B. Most students have never seen a C. And so when they get to college, and if they see a C, that to them is the equivalent of failing. So when you have high school grades go up, it's almost expected that college grades will go up as well. So it's impossible to probably look at grade inflation at the college level without considering the fact that students' expectations as to what a grade means have changed when they enter college.
Let's go to Anne now, joining us from Campbell's Fort. Good morning, Anne.
Good morning. I had three kids going to college, and we paid tuition we couldn't afford. All three kids had some classes with professors or teachers from foreign countries who spoke very poor English, and my kids struggled to understand them. There were a lot of complaints, and I wonder if that impacted higher grades.
Stuart, what do you make of that?
I don't know whether foreign-born professors grade easier or higher than Native English speakers grade easier or harder than non-Native English-speaking parents. Sorry, it's a little bit early in the morning for me, so sometimes my words are a little jumbled. Excuse me.
That's okay.
That's nothing that I've looked at, but I do know that complaints about the English-speaking abilities of professors have been pervasive for many decades. it's a common complaint. It certainly hasn't. I don't know, certainly, but it looks like it's been a background real problem and complaint for a long period of time. It's funny, I'm having problems with English.
Well, let's...
English
no sweat.
And professor done that. That's ironic. Okay,
so,
go ahead.
So, Stuart, how do we turn this conversation then and look for solutions? You know, where do we go from here?
Well, there are schools that have tackled this problem successfully and have, from on high, at the dean level, at the president level, said we have to end grade inflation and keep grades in check. And they have done so because of top-down pressure. They're small schools like Reed College in Oregon, where grades have remained steady for the past 25 years or so, and that seems to just be part of the culture. It's harder to do at a bigger school. Princeton is bigger than Reed. Again, there was top-down pressure to hold grades in check, and they had done so until the new president came, felt the pressure from parents and alumni who wanted grades to go up and be similar to what was seen at other Ivy League schools like Princeton, like Harvard and Yale, and grades have gone back up again. So it can change from a top-down attitude. But rather than focus on the grades themselves, I think we need to increasingly think about what a college education is about and bring that discussion to the fore. Is it about advancing someone's career once they get out of college and graduate, or is it about the knowledge they obtain when they're there? Are they customers or are they students? And I think the pushback has to come from culture, whether it be parents or whether it be legislators, and I know legislators have a thing about how awful colleges are in a way that I don't agree, that the emphasis needs to be on the actual education, not on the outcome of that education, which means not on an outcome of graduation rates, not on the outcome of our students getting into the better graduate schools, are they getting the better professional schools, but on what is actually being taught in the classroom. One way to possibly do that, and it's a way that would be very difficult and certainly would get a lot of pushback, is to make college affordable again. A lot of the pressure that comes from making college easier, rising grades, comes a result of the high level of tuition that parents have to pay and students have to pay increasingly to attend school. So they feel like they need to get something in return, which is a better outcome. If colleges were more affordable, that pressure would be lessened, and we may be able to return to a time when colleges emphasized education rather than postgraduate outcomes.
Let's bring in Chris in Milwaukee. Chris, go ahead.
Hello.
Hi, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Hey. Yeah, I guess, and this may have been addressed months earlier in the program. I came in a little bit late, but I was just wondering if there's a marked difference between like the humanities and maybe the sciences. And the reason I ask is I'm an English major, and my experience in the English program at the four-year school I went to was that as long as I was writing papers that the professor agreed with and using the critical methods that they agreed with, I would see good grades to the extent that, I mean, for my capstone seminar, I effectively did not read the paper or read the book rather that I wrote the paper on and received an A solely because the critical method I used, the methodology I used was in line with the teachers or the professors rather. So I'm just wondering if maybe the humanities and sort of them becoming a little more lax in terms of close reading and things of that nature, if that at all might be in effect. And I can take my answer off the air.
Yeah, Stuart, go ahead.
Humanities classes have tended to grade easier than social science classes, and social science classes have tended to grade easier than physical science, natural science classes for decades. So what we see over the last 30 years is that everyone's grading easier, but their starting points are different. So the average GPA in a humanities class is about 0.4 higher than in a typical science class. The average GPA in a social science class is about 0.2 higher than it is in a natural science class. And so if you look at those three major disciplines, you find that all of them are seeing grade rises, but there are three parallel lines separated about a 0.2 GPA gap between them. And then there are trends like education schools for decades have graded much higher than liberal arts colleges. Nursing schools and music schools have graded higher. Again, those are parallel lines that are at the humanities level for an entire school. So there have been long-term cultural differences between grading practices from school to school and from discipline to discipline. They exist today. They existed 50 years ago.
So having researched all of this, Stuart, wondering if you think that grades are a good indicator of student performance, and if they're not, is there a better way?
Increasingly, they are not a good indicator of what a student has learned. Because what's happening is that all the grades are getting bunched up at the high level, and trying to determine whether one student is better because they have a 3.7 GPA versus another student who has a 3.6 GPA, maybe better or worse, is a meaningless exercise. So, you know, the question is, what do you do in terms of evaluation of a student when you're a potential employer of that student? In my case, over much of my career, whether that student is going to be a graduate student of mine. And I certainly discounted grades more and more as years went by. And what was more important in evaluation was actually seeing the whites of their eyes and talking to them for about an hour or two and trying to understand who they were. Evaluations were relatively meaningless as well because everyone found three people to say that they were wonderful and that they could walk on water. So in terms of evaluation of students, you have to go on something else.
Well,
we're
going to have to leave it there. Stuart, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Stuart Roystacher is a writer-scholar, former professor of geophysics at Duke University. He's done extensive research on grade inflation, the results of which can be found on his website, gradeinflation.com. This hour of the morning show was produced by Chris Molina and Keely Baltina. Michael Deringer provided technical direction. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the Ideas Network.